This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, September 22nd, 2010. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, a poem frozen in time. In about 1923, Robert Frost read a poem by the 26-year-old Louise Bogan and remarked, "That woman will be able to do anything." A few decades later, W.H. Auden said that Louise Bogan was one of only four American poets. Real poets, I guess he meant. The other three were T.S. Eliot, Laura Riding, and Marianne Moore. High praise, but Louise Bogan's reputation never really soared during her life, and her work probably still doesn't get the attention it deserves. You'll probably think she does deserve that attention when you hear the poem we're about to play for you. I'm joined by Mary Kinsey, who is on the phone from Northwestern University in Chicago, where she teaches. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
When did you first read Louise Bogan's poetry, and what effect did it have on you as a reader and a poet?
Well, she was the first poet that I read, period.
Wow.
And I found it exceedingly difficult. So it's taken me many decades to come to the point where I know and value the poems that don't give you everything right away, and which also don't yield answers to all of one's questions.
Now, a few years ago, you edited a book called A Poet's Prose, Selected Writings of Louise Bogan,
mm-hmm.
and you are also the executor of her literary estate, so you know a fair bit about her. And the general take on her is that she wrote her best stuff when she was in her 20s and early 30s, and then she really struggled to write poetry for the rest of her life,
mm-hmm.
in spite of being the New Yorker poetry editor for many years and being very involved in literary circles.
Mm-hmm.
Is that more or less right?
I think that's true. And she thought of her pattern as the pattern of the lyric poet. In other words, that the lyric was written by the young person, not by the middle-aged or the older poet.
Yeah, and she also believed, and you point this out in your introduction to the book of her prose, she also believed that poetry itself could fall asleep for centuries. It wasn't just an individual's problem. It could be a cultural problem as well. It could just not exist.
She said that in the context of lambasting what she called the middle. She associated, you know, sort of middling minds with journalism and the Sunday supplement. And she said, the middle wants poetry to throb without ceasing. But poetry sometimes falls asleep for a century at a time.
That's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And true, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're going to listen to Louise Bogan read a poem from her first book, Body of This Death, wonderful title, which came out when she was just 26 years old. The poem itself is called Medusa, whom everyone remembers as the woman who had the snake hair.
Mm-hmm.
But remind us, if you would, of the story of Medusa.
Medusa was one of three sisters. She was the only one who was mortal. She was also very beautiful.
Uh-huh.
And as happens frequently in the myths, a god noticed her and importuned her, this was Poseidon, in Athena's temple. And because Medusa was the occasion for this unconquerable desire on Poseidon's part, and because the couple thereby desecrated her temple, she cursed Medusa with this terrible enchantment that whoever she looked upon would be turned to stone. And then eventually, when attempts had been made to get rid of Medusa because of all this stone that was standing around or increasing statuary everywhere, Perseus, with Athena's tutelage, took a highly burnished, polished shield, and looking in the shield at the reflection, was able to behead her. And out of the blood that fell on the sand, Pegasus was born, the winged horse of poetry, and also the springs of the stream of the poet's Helicon.
So it's a rich myth. There's a lot going on in there. And we're going to talk about the poem afterwards, so we don't want to give away her very peculiar approach to Medusa right now. But it's important to know that the poem takes place before Medusa's head was cut off. Here is Louise Bogan reading Medusa for the Library of Congress in 1944.
Medusa. I had come to the house in a cave of trees, facing a sheer sky. Everything moved. A bell hung ready to strike. Sun and reflection wheeled by. When the bare eyes were before me, and the hissing hair, held up at a window, seen through a door, the stiff, bald eyes, the serpents on the forehead, formed in the air. This is a dead scene forever now. Nothing will ever stir. The end will never brighten it more than this, nor the rain blur. The water will always fall and will not fall, and the tipped bell make no sound. The grass will always be growing for hay deep on the ground. And I shall stand here like a shadow under the great balanced day, my eyes on the yellow dust that was lifting in the wind and does not drift away.
It truly is extraordinary.
She reads wonderfully well with a little bit of that starch in her voice that I always associate with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Very Boston.
Yeah, she grew up in I guess, in Maine and then in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to write a poem about a mythical figure like Medusa, but it's another entirely to insert a lyrical eye into the story, isn't it? This is quite unusual.
Mm-hmm. It's also the style of narration we all fall into when we're narrating a dream or a nightmare. You know, here's where I was. I had come to this place.
I had come to the house in a cave of trees, facing a sheer sky.
And you don't know why it's this place. You know, there's no ordinary reality clinging to it. It's also not an impersonation. The eye is not a stand-in for Perseus. In other words, this is not the hero going to slay the Medusa. I'm not sure that we encounter Medusa before she is beheaded.
When the bare eyes were before me and the hissing hair held up at a window.
You can only hold up the hair if she has been beheaded.
Ah, so I thought that she had to have her power of freezing people in place, and I thought she had to have... I thought that was only valid before she lost her head.
No, in fact, when Perseus has slain her, he is reluctant to put her head face down into the sand. There is something repellent about that. So he gathers a little bit of seaweed and puts it down so that the head will have something to rest on. And the Medusa head turns the seaweed to coral.
Uh-huh.
And Perseus carried it around in a sack and took it out when he wanted to deal with his enemies.
As you said, what's not mentioned in the poem is why the speaker went to Medusa in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the speaker was after?
I really think that this is an ordeal. It's a test, in the same way that our nightmares are tests, where we replay what's happened to us, but in a highly dramatized form. But to think about the poet's motives for a moment, I think that Bogan is trying to capture the sense of encountering something that is not only completely foreign and dangerous and horrifying, but that is something like an alter ego, a double of the self. She's looking into this face as if into a mirror.
The stiff, bald eyes, the serpents on the forehead, formed in the air. This is a dead scene forever now. Nothing will ever stir. The end will never brighten it more than this, nor the rain blur.
It's not just this locale that's dead, it's everything that's dead. It's time that is dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's a true nightmare in that everything is destroyed. It's a kind of apocalypse.
What are we to make of that? Is this death, or is this some sort of frozen identity? What are we to make of that?
I think it's more local than that. Not to become too biographical, though the first step in this direction was taken by Theodore Rutke in the 60s, who said that this was a poem in which the writer absolutely penetrated to the psychic depths and, you know, comes into conflict or confrontation with the anima. He was using Jungian terms.
Mm-hmm. The
female spirit of any artist, and mm-hmm. maybe even her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And Gauguin's mother was a sort of frustrated artist, a very attractive and flamboyant woman who married, quote-unquote, beneath her. She had affairs, and Gauguin was taken along.
As a child, right?
As a child. Mm. And when she was 5 or 6, she became blind for a few days.
Really?
The mother's behavior was reprehensible in every conceivable way, but the damage to her daughter was rather extreme. So it's as if the beloved mother is also the monster. And it's not as if the world will be a more interesting or bearable place after this paralysis occurs. It's as if time has been denied or cut off.
The water will always fall and will not fall. And the tipped bell make no sound.
The language of this poem illustrates Gauguin's ability to make simple words multi-layered. For example, the serpents on the forehead formed in the air. That's it's a very bland verb, and yet it helps us see these coiling serpent.
Because when you expect an object to follow that form something, and she doesn't have the object, she forces us to imagine what that object is.
They formed their own tortuous paths in the air,
yeah.
But also what they did was perform the curse.
Ah.
In other words, that's the moment of paralysis, because after it, it's like the volta in a sonnet. This is a dead scene forever now.
Uh-huh.
There are just so many wonderful things.
The grass will always be growing for hay.
I think it's a farmer's phrase.
Growing for hay, right.
Right.
Deep on the ground.
And deep on the ground, I mean, deep is beneath, but on is above, so that she is playing with something that's a little bit self-canceling or contradictory, so that we'll see a field of hay.
And I shall stand here like a shadow under the great balanced day.
What does that mean, balanced? You know, is it noon? Is it a perfect balance? But she's a shadow, so it couldn't be noon.
Right.
Because there would be no shadow thrown. I guess I would say that balanced stands for suspended.
Mm-hmm.
Under the great balanced day. It's also balanced in the sense that things are at their perfect ripeness and they'll never be harvested.
And I shall stand here like a shadow under the great balanced day, my eyes on the yellow dust that was lifting in the wind and does not drift away.
Is this, I said at the top of the program, this is one of her best poems. Would you agree?
Yes.
Would you say that this is a great poem?
Yes. I think that, you know, one way of testing it on yourself would be to ask whether the poem could exist without its last stanza. In other words, is it merely the shock and the horror of being paralyzed or transformed? And I think that the poem gives us, it's not a sign of hope, but there is something so beautiful about the idea of this dust that's still dispersed in the air, and it will never settle.
Yeah,
you know,
something.
The air will always be yellow with, you know, with pollen or homes of hay or.
Beautiful yet uncomfortable, because one thinks of dust.
Yes.
Mary Kenzie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mary Kenzie's latest book of poems is California Sorrow, published by Knopf. She is also the author of A Poet's Guide to Poetry, which has survived many purges of my bookshelves over the years. You can read a handful of her poems on our website, poetryfoundation.org. You can subscribe to this podcast in the iTunes store. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.